Well, welcome. Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com, as well as podcasting these programs on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and a bunch of others. And we certainly hope that you will avail yourselves of these radio broadcasts, these podcasts, if you will. Be sure you listen to the whole thing. And then by that, I mean, if you're listening to the radio broadcast, you better go to SoundCloud. Listen to the whole thing. Because, hey, depending upon our guest's availability, who knows? Maybe our guest today, David Finkel, will give us an hour or so to chat about the subject that we're going to talk about today, which happens to be the freedom formula and how to succeed in business without sacrificing your family, your health, or your life. That last one, crucial, because if you sacrifice the third, you've already lost the first two. David, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
I appreciate it, Richard.
This is interesting because we're all looking for quote-unquote freedom. Freedom to or freedom from. It has always been said, and I remember this in some of the programs I've been through over the years, personal growth programs, that when you are running away from something, you're running to, and vice versa. If you're running to something, you're usually running away from something. Is that along those lines here where, you know, we're looking for freedom? Okay, well, what is it that we feel that we currently have if we don't think that we actually have the freedom to do what it is that we want to do?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up an interesting point. Generally speaking, for my world, I come from more of a hard business background. So I tend to stay in my own lane. I've learned for me that the people that I've tended to work with or have gravitated or read books that I've done, that the mindset piece of it tends to be a lot smaller. They tend to come to me because they want specifics and how-tos from that. You know, more about, look, everyone tells me what I need to do, but no one tells me how I do the what to do. So give me the understanding, David, about how do I actually succeed professionally, whether it be owning my own business or as a very successful employee in someone else's company, but do it in a way where I can still have a life. And that's what this book does. It operationalizes what does it mean to work smarter in the nitty-gritties, even in the face of 100 emails a day and Slack channels that are overfull and texts that come in at odd moments and customers that have needs for me and bosses or employees that have fires that I need to put out. You know, it's easy to do it in a laboratory, but how do I do it in the marketplace? And that's why I wrote the book.
Well, I know that, as they say, everybody has a book in them somewhere, and it all depends upon where you're coming from. I remember, speaking of freedom, I remember listening to a speech given by then presidential candidate Al Gore back in 2000. And I don't remember the exact words. I just remember the basic gist. And he was talking, blah, 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 freedom, freedom. Here's what we, you and me, American citizens, here's what we're going to do. And I'm thinking, oh, fantastic. We're going to work together. We're going to achieve something. It's going to be great. We're going to feel this excitement and freedom to do these things, right? And then he says, and now here's what the government's going to do for you. And I turned off the TV. I kid you not. I said, Al Gore giveth and Al Gore taketh away. You freed us from the chains and then you shackled us back up again with telling us what the government's going to do for us. Because it's been said that the government can't do anything better than the private sector. And it's kind of been proven over and over again. But that seems to sort of be the message that goes around in a lot of circles. And the feeling is, I'll give you a case in point, David, and that has to do with an experience that my present wife and I had back in 2005. I was working for a radio station in Phoenix, and a company came in to buy our station and another and said that, told the newspapers, this station, which I was working for, oh, profitable. I mean, we actually did break even in 9 months, which is unheard of in radio. Oh, they're profitable. No, we're not going to change the format. Well, because of the fact that they were of a particular philosophy, I knew they were lying because there's no way they would ever keep this format based upon their beliefs. So January rolls around and we're all being told everybody's being laid off as of the end of February because the format's being changed and they're not keeping anybody from this side. So my last day was February 28th. On March 1st, the next day, my wife calls me, having worked in a hospital in a supervisory position for probably less than 3 months. Very hostile work environment. She says, I just quit. And, of course, in my head, I'm screaming, do you know I'm unemployed too? And yet, it opened the doors for us to move to Santa Barbara. Now, here's what's interesting. And I'm going to actually pose this as a question. Did we actually have the freedom to move to Santa Barbara even before we both lost our jobs? Or did we actually have to wait? So let's put that in a general term for others who feel like they're trapped, like they're enslaved, like they're chained to that desk.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me when you say that, because of course, it's if you're in a room and the door is closed and the door we think is locked, then we're stuck. We're trapped. Yet if the door was open all the time, but we didn't know it, we still behave as if we were trapped. And I'll tie that back in with this idea that people are working in their careers. Again, whether they're an owner of a business or whether they're a self-employed professional or a key executive in someone else's company. And the deal is, there's this meme that says the only way we succeed is by working harder. And I call this the two economies, Richard. Mm-hmm. The one economy is the time and effort economy. And in the time and effort economy, we think we're getting paid for hours, effort, and attitude. I mean, if I were to put it to a Hollywood movie, I would probably say it's Rocky Balboa model, right? You know, and you say, oh, hey, Rocky, he was a world championship. And I say, well, yes, but number one, that was Hollywood in the 1970s. And number two, there's got to be a better model to succeed professionally than just absorbing years and years of punishment to have that fleeting moment at the top. The second model, though, is a completely different way of framing it. And we call this the value economy. And in the value economy, I don't get paid for time. I get paid for results. I get paid for creating value to the marketplace. I need time, but I need a specific and better type of time. I need blocks of my best attention focused on those points of maximum impact. And not just for me, you know, one of the things that's important, and in the Freedom Forum, we talk about how do I get myself and my team's best attention focused on those things that matter most. And it doesn't take a lot. You know, at one law firm I work with, I'll give an example. I was working with a senior partner of a small law firm. I wrote about the story in the introduction of the book. And, you know, here's a guy who's charging billing at $600 per hour in his firm. So he makes a lot on an hourly basis. And he thought all that he did that created value was him as an hourly person, someone who billed his clients. And he was working 70 to 75 billable hours on an average week, which meant he was working probably 85 hours per week, which is just insane from a sustainability standpoint. And so I talked with him. I said, well, what you're doing here is important, but you're not doing the highest value. You have things that you can do for your practice that are even more valuable. And he challenged me, well, what could they be? And I pointed out a few. For example, his collection practices and his billing decisions about how much to charge and reducing the discounts that he gave when paralegals did work. And he just made a few changes. It took probably 5 or 6 hours of his time and about another 20 hours of his number two person in the office time to implement. His firm increased their bottom line profit, not gross revenue, but bottom line profit by over $800,000 a year. And when you look at it by an hourly basis, Richard, that's about $25,000 to $50,000 per hour for that. It's a very different thing. So what causes most of us to not get that, and you brought up about the idea, if I don't think I'm free, am I? Which is this desire for control. And there's actually a medical condition that causes it. It's the inflammation of your control gland. It's called control-itis. And this is what traps most successful people in just endless rounds of doing. They're scared of the feeling of being helpless or being at passively watching someone else do it different than they would. And in our head, when we watch someone do it differently, we say they're not doing it as well. And that costs us quite a bit. And that's probably the biggest chain In the book, we talk about the five chains that hold us in the time and effort economy. That's probably the most common chain that causes people to work so much harder than actually makes sense, and doing things that really make no sense for their business lives.
Well, I will tell you that it sounds to me, and this is sort of what I've been learning through some of the interviews I've been doing when we start talking about the guests' focus primarily on business, is that a lot of the same rules apply outside the business world.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the things I think that a lot of people forget. Now, you happen to be the CEO of, if I'm correct, I've got this pronounced right, the Maui Mind Mastermind.
Which That's right.
is one of the world's premier business coaching companies. You've been dealing with a whole lot of folks and so forth. And I'm wondering if when you hold these workshops and seminars and things of this nature, if you have people who repeat, because sometimes it's important to repeat so that it can kind of continue to reinforce those lessons that you're trying to get across. They come to you maybe after, you know, this. Maybe they do this on an annual basis. I don't know. And they come to you and say, you know what? The stuff you told us last time, I've been doing that at work, but, you know, it's sort of been overflowing into my private life. And I got to tell you, my private life is, you know, it's not Skittles and beer, but it ain't bad. You know, there's always room for improvement, but I'm using some of these techniques. Have you gotten that?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I've had it both ways. So, you know, for us, most of the people we work with as clients tend to be owners of small businesses between maybe $1 million and $25-30 million per year in revenue. And so, you know, we'll take things, what's interesting, so they'll take things from the programs that we do or from the biweekly coaching they're doing with a coach, and they certainly will apply it. And I'll share a story of how I've done that as someone who's taken some reason to help me be a better dad. But what I think is also fascinating, Richard, is a lot of the people we end up working with are growing a team, and they take some of these parenting things that they've learned with their kids and apply it to their business. And I'll give a quick example on that too. So one of our coaches, Steve Maxwell, a good friend of mine, started off maybe, what was it, 16 years ago as a client, and for about the last 7 or 8 years has been one of our coaches and really successful business person in of his own right. But he shared something with me as a dad. He said, David, you know, when your kids are young, you need to make sure you write this down. He said, gentle pressure applied relentlessly to help shape them. And I thought, wow. And I started doing it with my kids. But more than that, I found as I've grown companies that one of the things that I need to do as a leader in a business is when I want to make change in the company, I can't drown my people. I've got to, we call it drip, don't drown. But I have to do it gently over time, relentlessly. I've got to stay on that message again and again. So I think it works both ways. And for me in the business, you know, you think about how do we create the most value in the business? Well, we have a kind of a way of looking at business. So everyone's probably heard of Pareto's principle, this 80-20 rule. You know, 80% of what we do is very low value, creates 20% of our result. But 20% of what we do is high value and creates 80% of the result. Well, if we take that and kind of put it on steroids, take it to its most productive extreme, if 20% of what I do creates 80% of the result, then 20% of that 20% gives me 80% of the 80%. What that means is 4% of what I do gives me 64% of the result. And if I do it one more time, roughly 1% gives me half the result. And what I know is, as a husband or as a dad, I can ask myself, just like I do in my business, I want to know in writing. One of the things in the third chapter of the Freedom Formula we talk about is putting down in writing, what do you do? The 3 to 5 things that actually create the most value for your company in writing. Well, I've done the same thing for myself as a husband and as a dad. I've asked my wife, what are the things that I do in the relationship that really delight you the most? I don't always follow it because I'm a boneheaded idiot sometimes. but at least I know what they are. And as a dad, I can sometimes still react and I blow up at my kids too, just like every parent. But I know what it is that creates the most, I'll use the word value, but really the most that deepens the relationship that serves my kids and helping them grow into be good human beings and people as they get older. So I totally agree that it goes both ways. You become a better parent and a better individual through business. And you become a better business person through what you've learned as an individual and as a parent and in a relationship.
I know that when I first started in business and And that was when I first started working. And there were a few jobs that I had that, I had supervisors and that kind of thing. But when I became one, in one of the radios, yeah, exactly. When I became a supervisor.
You became one of them?
I became one of them.
You became, oh my gosh. So you went over to the other side. Okay, keep going. I'm curious now.
And the reality, well, here's the interesting thing about going to the other side. I didn't really go to the other side because even in my supervisory position, I still had to do the same tasks that everybody else I was supervising was doing. I had to do an 8-hour shift. I had to play the programming and the format and all of this kind of stuff just like they did. So I had the hands-on experience not only to show them how to do it, to train them, but also when there were problems, I could talk them through it over the phone, those kinds of things. So it was one of those, I would say, unique supervisory positions where, and I honestly believe this, every supervisor should know how to do the tasks that they're asking everybody else that they're supervising to do. Otherwise, in my opinion, they're absolutely of no value to the company. They won't be able to step in if someone is injured or someone is sick, and then the productivity of the company starts to wane while this person is not available. On top of the fact, if somebody's having trouble with a particular task, how is this supervisor really supposed to help them? Okay. Well, early on in my career, I took on, and this is how I describe it, I took on a supervisory style that I found very quickly did not work. I refer to it as my Hitlerian phase.
Oh, no.
And I told them that they needed to do it because I was the supervisor. And I thank God that the universe gave me my comeuppance in that, because one of my staff, who I've never said the staff worked for me, never, even in that phase, they worked with me. This one staff member, he said to me, he says, "I'm not going to do it." I says, "Well, why not?" He says, "Because you're telling me I'm to do this." So I had to find another way to phrase the task so that he would go ahead and do this. And I was able to do so. I said, "Well, this task needs to be done because we have other staff and programmers who are going to come into this building, and that room needs to be kept clean. So I'll do it for that reason, but not because you're telling me to." So I immediately gave up that particular style. And again, I adopted the coworker attitude. And it wasn't trying to be friends with everybody, but it was trying to recognize and let them recognize that, hey, if I have to clean the toilets, then you guys can clean the toilets too, okay?
That's right. That's right.
And I think that's one of the things that's lost. That's why I have a real problem with these CEOs who get these million-dollar bonuses at the end of the year. And it's like, wait a minute, what did you do that increased the productivity and the profitability of this company? And I say you didn't do anything, because it was the people at the bottom of the wide space of the pyramid. They are the ones that made you the millions of dollars, because they were there working, doing their jobs.
What you say there, you said two things that really sparked me. So one was this idea that at the workplace, hey, don't tell me I have to do it. You know, in the second half of the book, we talk about these five accelerators, things that help a company, a team, a department, a division go faster and create results, more value with less time and effort. And one of them is the accelerator of engaging your team. And I share some stats in there. It's staggering. In the world of nonprofits, each year, there's over $1 trillion, not billion, trillion with a T, $1 trillion worth of time given and donated, not money, but time donated to nonprofits around the world. It's staggering. And why do people go to a nonprofit? Well, they go there because they want to feel part of something. They feel a sense of identity for it. They feel like they're doing good in the world, so it feels affirming. They feel important. They're making a contribution. They're growing. All these things. And yet most employers, if we're not careful, we say, well, why does Joey and why does Linda, why does Rosario stay with us? Well, because we pay them. If the only thing holding your team to your company, the only thing that helps you engage your team, is the fact that you pay them, I can almost guarantee you, and the stats we shared in the book are pretty darn convincing, that the moment something goes on in that person's life, they're going to leave. Which brings up the second point. You talked in there about You know, if you don't have multiple people who know how to do something, what happens if someone gets hurt or a family member does, or they get recruited away? We call this strategic depth. So when we talk about creating more value, one of the ways we sustain that, it's the fourth step of the four-step formula, is this idea that we've got to build strategic depth, which takes cross-trained team, really good systems, and a culture that says in our company, we make sure that we back each other up, that there's always a redundancy there so that, you know, if someone's on vacation, if someone's hurt, if somebody needs to go away for an extended leave because of an elderly family member who's, you know, in hospice or heaven forbid any of these things. And most companies also, what'll happen is they have a great person and they'll just give more and more to that person and they have no depth. And unfortunately, the moment something goes on in that person's life, the rest of their coworkers, their customers, the company is at risk, and we've got to defend against that. We've got to be proactive and start taking steps bit by bit, incrementally, to increase strategic depth in our company or our department or on our team.
I want to bring up a prime example. It's a current day example of what you're talking about. My intention is not to be political, but is to use it as an example. The current leader of the free world hired I don't know how many people at the beginning of his term, claims that he's one of the greatest businessmen that has ever lived, and supposedly has been the most successful. And yet I don't see success per se, although I'm trying to eliminate those two words, success and failure, from my vocabulary, because when you take a look at people like Edison, who invented the working light bulb, he was asked how many times he failed. He says, I never failed. I just found 990 ways it didn't work. So there's a big difference between failure and the evolutionary process of an idea. So he hires X number of people, and after even after the first year, dozens of them are fired. They quit, they can't take it or whatever, they go on to other things, and so new people have to be hired. Now, I don't know what the exact statistics are in business, but I do know that it is not cheap to bring in new people every time a person leaves, and I have to wonder what this attrition costs, not just the government, but this kind of attrition would cost a company, a business, if this percentage of people constantly are going through the revolving door. So when you take a look at your workplace, whether you're the owner, the manager, or an employee, a coworker, that's something that I don't think a lot of people really think of. And it isn't there a certain element of, and maybe it's rightly so, self-centeredness by each of the individuals involved in the company. Certainly, I would love to be paid a six-figure amount, and I'm still looking for that, and I hope someday it is. But at the same time, you know what? I'm doing pretty good. I mean, how many people can say they're living in Santa Barbara and yet able to work one job and do that? That's pretty astounding. So what about this aspect of the individuals involved in the operations of a company, and maybe they're a little more focused on self than they are on keeping the company going so they have a job tomorrow?
Yeah. You know, as you say that, why is it that people disengage, right? They don't feel affirmed. They don't feel important. They feel that there's just silliness that gets in their way. And so there's an exercise I would share with your listeners here. And so a friend of mine who I co-wrote my last book, Scale, with, he's one of the people who started a tiny travel website that grew to be a behemoth. It's called Priceline.com. His name's Jeff. You know, one day somebody asked Jeff in his business and said, Jeff, you know, what's our policy about how we're supposed to manage people? And Jeff kind of grabbed everyone and put them in a conference room. This is with one of his other startups. And he had them take out a sheet of paper. Simple exercise. Says, draw a vertical line down the middle. On the left-hand side there, write down, I want you to think of the companies that you worked for, the managers that you worked under that were horrible, that brought out the worst in you, that were petty, that made you feel belittled, that made you feel really disengaged. What did they do? How did they treat you that made you feel that way? give them a moment to write that down, and said, great, now on the right-hand side, I want you to write down the opposite. I want you to think of those managers who absolutely you would go through fire for, you would burst through brick walls for, that brought the best out on you, companies that you loved working for and felt proud to be there. What did they do? How did they treat you? What were the qualities that you saw? Write that down. And just simply said, look, now you have a list here. You know, don't do anything on the left-hand side of that sheet of paper. Do it on the right. But share it with each other. This is the place we want to build. And let's all of us try to do what's on the right-hand side. And what was interesting was 90% what was on the right-hand side and the left-hand side was the same for everybody. You know, we talk about this in the second half of the book, The Freedom Formula, under the section on culture. We can build a company that does what's on that right-hand side. And people want the same things, whether they're millennials, Generation X, or whether they're, you know, a few more baby boomers that still work for us. We want to feel important. We want to feel part of something. We want to feel like we have a voice. And so here's my big comment for you, for any listener. We've got to give people a meaning, you know, shaping the meaning of what they're doing and helping them recognize that they have a voice and a place. You know, not everyone can run the company, but they can still make a contribution. And when people know that what they do matters and how it fits into the larger picture, and we give them the courtesy, the respect, and we don't do stupid stuff like say, well, gosh, I need you here because, you know, the policy says you can't leave to go watch your daughter do a performance at her high school. We don't do stupid stuff. People stay with us longer. And as a result, our company's going to be really successful.
Yeah,
because we don't have all this turnover, which is what you were talking about.
Here's a big one. A story came out in the mid-1980s. I know that's going back a ways, but it still applies. I think it was on CBS Radio, and it was there once. I found that fascinating that the story was only on one time. Motorola, at that time, was going to lay off 1,000 people. And the story went on to explain why. Because an internal audit showed that approximately $1 million worth of materials were missing over the course of that year. And apparently the word in the story was pilfered, i.e. that the people working at Motorola allegedly didn't think Motorola was paying them enough, so they figured they were entitled to take a stapler or take this or that or the other thing. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of those 1,000 people who were laid off back then weren't doing the pilfering. You know how the law of attraction works. And I almost got sucked into that mentality early in my career. When I went to work for a Christian station, a lot of the people we would hire and we would go through the job description. Yes, toilets will be cleaned, garbage will be taken out, etc. And they would say, you guys don't pay me enough to do that. It's like, excuse me, the job description was given to you at the front end of this. It isn't a question of whether we're paying you enough. You agreed to the payment, to the pay for the job description that we laid out. And I basically was fortunate in my career to be given many different opportunities. Now, maybe part of it was as a manager I was given them, but nonetheless, where I was actually able to interview people such as yourself for 30-minute interviews that would air at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time or Mountain time Monday through Friday. So I, you know, and of course, I wasn't getting paid any extra for this. They just said, okay, you want to fill the time? Then you go ahead and fill the time. And I could have looked at it and gone, well, yeah, but this is extra work. And, you know, I'm not getting paid anymore. And I said, no. I mean, I would interview musicians. I would get CDs. I would interview people who are putting on workshops and seminars. I'd maybe get a tape series or a book or what have you, in addition to the connection, the contact, in addition to the interview and the experience doing the interview. And it's one of the reasons, it's part of the reason I say that that 15 years at that Christian radio station, it was the best education I was ever paid for. I couldn't probably have never been able to afford to get that kind of experience at any kind of college or university. And yet I got paid. in books and contact and experience and so forth. Are the millennials of that mindset, as far as you're able to tell? Because this is the juxtaposition I find myself in, David. I'm having trouble relating to the different groups of people that are alive today, from the baby boomers, and there's a name for every generation between me and the younger set. Are we really all that different?
That's a great question. You know, whether it's, you know, Gen Z, those born in 1995 to 2015, millennials, 1980 to 1994, whatever the dates and years are. Mm-hmm. So I was at an event of ours, and we were talking about hiring. It was really interesting, and so we were doing a mock interview, because, you know, we tend to coach, you know, business owners and their key staff about how to scale their company, and certainly hiring comes up a lot. And so as we were teaching this session about how to interview the correct way and how do you bring out the right information, somebody in the audience stood up and asked and said, "Well, gosh, these new, you know," they didn't actually say it very nicely. They said, "These new millennials, they just want to be affirmed, and Generation Z is even worse, I'm hearing, and these millennials just want to be able to award for it." And I laughed. Why? Because when they said, "Well, what does a millennial want?" And they listed off things like they want to be acknowledged, they want to be seen, they want to do something that means something, they want. And what was interesting is we just asked the audience, how many of you want to do work that matters? How many of you want to be seen? How many of you want to have some sense of fairness and equity in the workplace? How many of you want respect? And there was no hand that wasn't up, Richard. So I agree that there's some different norms and some changes perhaps about expectations, mm-hmm. but the underlying fundamental human needs have not changed at all. The only difference is a lot of people, depending on their generation, didn't have the same number of options. And so you have a millennial that has a feeling of a different range of options today than perhaps a generation did in the 80s or 90s, but the needs, the fundamental desires are the same. And if I can, as a leader in my company, tap into helping people feel part of something, tapping into the sense that people have a sense of autonomy and agency and all these other fundamental parts, my team is going to create more value, more committed results than if I just treat them as, you know, cogs in a wheel. There's no question about it. We both know that's true.
Yeah. I remember when I took this job over 11 years ago, full time, sat down with the boss, and we've been working really well together, got a lot of systems protocols set up to where we're able to catch mistakes before they actually happen, which is really neat. You know, and it's like, okay, get another set of eyes on that. And I would say that our error rate is down under 1%. And it's not that we're perfect by any means, but we have this system set up to where it just works. Anyway, we were sitting there in that initial meeting, you know, of course, talking about how much I wanted and this and that and the other thing. And when we were kind of finished, I said, "You know, I do realize that this is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job." He says, "Oh, no. It's just 8 hours a day, 5 days a week." Well, as an operations manager at other stations, I knew better than that, you know, because we have staff, we have equipment that needs to be maintained, we have power outages, we have all these different things that happen. I knew better than that, you know, but I wasn't going to sit there and correct him. I said, "Okay, fine. You know, you go ahead and believe what you want and I'll do the job." And I love this job. I really enjoy it. And yet at the same time, I'm sitting here going, you know, I can hardly wait to get to the day when I can turn the reins of this station over to someone else. And that's one of the reasons why, and this is something I'd like to talk about. I have done everything that I can do over the years with the staff that I've been able to work with to teach them everything I know. Because I also know that if I don't, I get stuck. That I am not going to defend and protect my turf. It's not my turf. What I do is my turf. Where I do it is a whole different thing. Do we still have that kind of attitude within the workplace today where, you know, again, people think that if I don't share this with someone else, I'll make myself invaluable and I'll never lose my job?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to flip that on its head there, Richard, and I would say the opposite from it. So coming from the perspective of the leader in a business, whether I'm managing a team of two people 200 people, 2,000 people, does not matter. Whether I'm an employee or the owner, does not matter. The key for me is I know I need to grow my people, and I need to take what I have in my head, and I've got to formalize into systems. I've got to cross-train my team members. And what I think, as someone who's hired hundreds of people over the years, the people that are most valuable are those that can replicate themselves in other people. They're so valuable, because the person who plays scare, the person who plays defense, by their very nature says that the way I create value is by my own personal hours and effort. That's the time and effort economy. They can create value, but the value they create is always going to have a cap to it, always limited. And when I have a team member, like I'll give an example in my company, there's a woman who works for me. She started off as my assistant about a decade ago. She's currently my company's COO. Her name's Teresa. She's amazing. She recognizes and has built a way to have, wherever she is, she's built someone underneath her to be as good as she is in that function, or as good as they're able to be, but can backfill the role. And by doing that, she's now showed that she should have a higher order of responsibility and rewards, because she's created commensurately more value for the company. So for the person who says, hey, if I don't tell other people how to do it, they can never fire me. First of all, having personally fired plenty of those people, that's not true. And second of all, it's the person who can create enough value and replace themselves that shows that they're capable of more, that I will fight tooth and nail to maintain and keep and find a place for those people, because those people are so rare in the business world. The others, a dime a dozen.
Yeah. I've trained a lot of people in this business, and I haven't trained enough. I wish that I could open my own school, but that's not the direction I want to go in my life. Yet I want to teach people about the fundamentals. You know, I realize you want to be creative. Unless you know the fundamentals, forget it. You've got no chance of making it. And this is the philosophy by which I train people. I'm going to show you, trainee, how I do it and the result that we get and want. And then when you're on your own, I want you to find your own way of doing it, even if it is using what I've shown you. I don't care if you do it standing on your head, you know, wearing flip-flops and a propeller beanie, okay?
No, not that, Richard, not that.
As long as you get the result we want, that's all that matters. And then I let him go. Now, I was listening to one of our, I'll call him former trainees, run a ball game the other night. And, of course, when I was training him and I would listen in early on after he was soloing, a little rough here and there. And I was listening. I'm going, am I working the ball game? Because, man, that sounds really good. I was very impressed. I was impressed. And I've even let him know in no uncertain terms, hey, you're doing a great job. It's sounding fantastic. And I think that that's one of the things too. And then, hey, when he would make a mistake, I would say, hey, what happened there? Tell me what happened there. Okay, then here's how you're going to stay on top of that so that doesn't happen again. And I've also tried to teach not to make the same mistake twice. If you're going to make a mistake, first of all, make it a big one, all right? But do your best never to repeat it. Because that's just what happens. You know, people, when I was being trained, they would come in and they would mess with my console. They would move the knobs and the switches and the dials and everything to screw me up, right? I don't do that. I tell them that story and I say, I don't need to do that. You're going to run into enough problems down the road that you'll have plenty of experience. Are we in a place in this country in particular? Because I listen to the commentary about new jobs that are created, and I wonder, well, what kind of jobs have been created that people really want? Manufacturing, that sounds like a great idea, but it just seems like we're in the 21st century. We should be doing more than making stuff. What about the entrepreneurial boom that came following the Great Recession of 2008-9? Is that a big deal? Getting out of the corporate world, getting out of the multi-employee situation, and starting your own thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been major shifts demographically in terms of what people are doing and where they look forward to gain security. And I think we're all clear that no one thinks, oh gosh, because I'm working for a Fortune 500 company that I'm going to have security around that part. We get that. The shift to business, it's interesting to me. A lot of people talk about this side hustle, and I just want to challenge that for a moment. So the premise of the Freedom Formula, the reason we wrote the book was, we don't succeed in business through hard work. We need to work smart and hard, yes, but we succeed by creating value. And so the time and effort economy says, you know, my boss is going to be upset if she sees I'm not busy, but the value economy says, my boss is going to be upset if she sees I'm not creating value. So coming back to this part, I don't want to just hustle. I think the key is I want to be economically stable. And to do that, I need to create value, which says, am I just busy right now, or am I actually doing things that matter? So for example, I know a lot of people that start quote unquote side businesses, projects on the side, and what they spend most of their time doing are things that don't actually generate revenue, which is a marker economically, not as a person. I'm not talking spiritually, I'm not talking character or health wise, but economically, they're not. If you're not getting paid for it, you're not creating value in the marketplace. If you were creating value in the marketplace, dollars would be changing hands, or yen or euros or whatever country you're listening to this from. So when I go back here, I ask myself, I think I need to clarify, go back to that 80-20 principle we talked about before. We call that that time value matrix. It's in chapter two of the book. And the sense that, what do I do that actually creates the most value? What's that 4% sweet spot of what I do? What's that 1% that I do that creates roughly half the result? You know, for example, you might say I'm the leader of a marketing department for a company. Okay, well, what do you do that actually creates value? I establish a really good brand voice to make sure that all the people in our company and the marketing use it the right way. I have great tracking and make good decisions about where we spend our marketing dollars so that we get the maximum return for each dollar spent. That's what you're on the payroll to do. But most people, if we really look at their time, it's kind of like a buffet. I love buffets, but most people go to a buffet and they do it all wrong. They go there and the first plate of food they take is all the junk stuff, the rich cakes and the pastas, and they fill themselves up on, pardon my language here, but just pure junk.
Mm-hmm.
The buffet, the most important plate of food, is my first plate of food. If I can have good vegetables and the high quality proteins for that first plate, even if I eat other junk food, number one, my stomach is partially filled, and number two, I've gotten the nutrition. So how can I, in my business day, make sure that I fill a portion of my business day first with the most business nutrition, high value activities? We call this focus days versus push days. And so a focus day is, we just pick one day of the week to start with. One day that I'm going to block off a 2 or 3 hour focus block. Maybe it's every Wednesday from 9 to 11, a 2 hour block, a 3 hour block, depending what I can do. I can do the rest of the week anyway that I want to, but that block is in my calendar as a recurring appointment. I'm looking at my, as we're recording this interview, I'm actually looking at my Outlook. I've got recurring appointments. For me, I do my focus days on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays. I do 3 days of it, but just start with one. And what do I fill in there? I ask myself, what do I do that creates the most value for my business, for my team, for my department, the things that I do in my job that create the highest economic return? And I give it 2 or 3 hours of my very best attention, no interruptions for that one block. And if I do that, over the course of the year, I'm going to get 4 extra 40-hour work weeks focused on things that create more value. There's no wonder that we're going to create more value. Plus, then on those other push days where I'm just pushing things one step further down the road, I can't control the whole day, but I can still give myself 1 hour block on each of those push days. Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday in this example. So I have a recurring appointment. So all I'm doing is I'm changing 5, 6, 7 hours out of a 40, 50-hour work week. So I still have plenty of other open space to do all the other day-to-day stuff. But the key is I want to give my best time to the things that matter most versus my remnant time to the things that matter most. I've got to give my best time in blocks to what actually creates value, not this leftover time in slivers to the stuff that I'm trying to cram in. Give the low value stuff your remnant time. Give your best stuff a concentrated block. And if I do that, I can create immense value without having to work nights and weekends and when I'm supposedly on vacation.
Oh, and the vacation, there's a word that I don't hear too often. I have to say that in 2016, when my wife and I went off on a week's vacation up north to Yosemite and then Nevada City, it was the first vacation that we had taken together in over 10 years.
Wow.
Since then, we haven't taken one, but in the process, we have acquired a truck, a Ford F-150, and just recently acquired a travel trailer. And both of these are part of a dream we both have had to go on the road, to travel, to visit different places and so forth. So now we have the opportunity, even if it's just a weekend, even if it's just we leave on a Friday, take the dog with us, and we stay Saturday, we stay Sunday, and we come back on Sunday. Then we go back to work, and at least we've had a little refresher. This Christmas, we're going to be driving out to Phoenix to visit my parents, and we're taking a week off from Friday the 20th through the holiday Christmas and probably coming back the following Monday. So, you know, it's like, okay, we didn't take vacations because my job kind of prohibited that, but I have now found new ways to arrange and rearrange and so on and so forth and configure my life to be able to not only accommodate her, but give myself a little bit of a break in spite of the fact that I love what I do. It's hard to let it go. And it's not a question of a workaholic from that standpoint of I got to work harder because I got to try to figure out how to bring in more money. It's like the money just seems to show up where I need it. And then I'm lucky. My dad gave me this piece of advice. I quote him a lot on this program, too, by the way. He says, find a job you love doing because you're going to be doing it for the rest of your life. For a long time. Don't get stuck like me. Now, he didn't stay stuck. He went to community college, got his computer programming degree when they had punch cards and fanfold paper. But is that an issue that you face a lot, both with yourself personally, but maybe with the people that you associate with, that you coach and so forth? Some of these people, they really do love their job and they just find it hard to let it go and get away and spend time with family, you know, that kind of thing?
What a great question. And so I'll tell you, for me, I remember I was taking a rafting trip with my dad. I was 29 years old. I was in the middle of my second company. The first failed. The second one was going really well. And we were doing this rafting trip in Canada. And there was this other guy on the trip. His name was Roy. And I still remember Roy. He was a very successful. I was at that time, that company was a real estate-based business. We were buying and renting out houses. And at that time, I think we were doing maybe 20 or 30 houses a year. At some point, the high point, we hit a couple hundred houses a year. But this guy was doing it in San Francisco on large scale, and he was a really, really nice man. And I kept picking his brain. Roy, what do you know about this? Roy, what about that? And one night I asked him by the fire at the end of a day of rafting. I said, what's been the biggest difference in your business life? And he said, David, it's been one thing. And I said, okay, what is it? And I'm laughing because it almost feels like that movie City Slickers when you ask Curly about what is that one thing that's successful. And he said, it's this trip. And I'm like, what do you mean this trip? He said, David, the fact that every quarter I force myself to take a week or more away from my business, it's forced my business to get better. I spot where there are reliances on me. I spot where they are. But also, as a business owner, we cast very big shadows. And as business leaders and executives, we cast big shadows. And so when we step away, whether it's for a weekend or even better for a week or more, it gives space and it forces and prompts other people to step up. And where they don't, now we know where we need to train and develop other people. So coming back to me, I made a decision when my kids were born. So the first company that I succeeded in building this real estate business, I sold it in 2005 and made a good amount of money with that. But I did it by a lot of effort, a lot of working. I didn't quite get the price that was paid. When my kids were born, I had twin boys and I have a third son now, but they're 10 years old now, almost 11. So it was about 12 years ago they were pregnant. When they came in, I held them in my arms. It was no longer an option to be doing the hours that I did before. And what I did is I made a decision. I said, I'm going to put a hard stop, 40 hours a week of work, 10 weeks of real vacation time a year. I made those decisions and it was really difficult for me to honor that. But by doing that, what I discovered as a side benefit were the businesses I built were better because I had to rely on other people. I had to grow my other people. I had to mature the systems of the company. I had to build a culture where that was important. So nowadays, if I have team members that don't take a vacation, like for example, I mentioned Teresa, she just went for her birthday every year. She goes for a long 5.5-7 day trip to watch a 49ers game with her sister and her girlfriends. And I think it's wonderful. When she leaves, we feel it sometimes. And there's good lessons about places where there's reliances on her. But if she doesn't take that time away, we can't grow. If I don't take that time away, the business is always going to stay stuck in its level. So I would encourage any leader who wants to grow a company or a department, take some time away, real vacation, not just working from a remote location, but actual real vacation. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing fertilizer to help the business or the team or the department grow.
Okay, I'm going to do it. I'll see you. You can finish the program and I'll just take off for parts unknown. This, to me, is incredibly important. It is, I think, critical to our success or our survival as a species, let alone as a society. And unless we start to take a look at some of these things, there is no hope for us. I don't care what we do elsewhere. We have to take that time for self and family and so forth. And one of the things that I did learn too, especially in reference to business, but primarily finance, and this is something that I really do my utmost, and sometimes it isn't easy to do because of circumstances. When the economy in general is contracting, i.e. 2008, 2009, the recession, you do not want to do that. You actually want to expand at those times because only your contraction only makes it even it'll make it even worse. And it is possible to expand. And it's counterintuitive, granted. And it's the same thing, for example, with my wife and I in this the truck and then the travel trailer. You know, we're not putting ourselves in financial danger, mind you, but we are expanding and anticipating that things will continue to grow and get better and be and we will become stronger and we'll have more fun. I when I think about the road trip in 2016, I can't tell you how excited just thinking about that time still makes me and the anticipation for being on the road in the not too distant future. And to that end, David Finkel, I want to thank you so much. Wall Street Journal bestselling co-author of another book called of Scales, co-author of Scales, The Freedom Formula, How to Succeed in Business Without Sacrificing Your Family, Health, or Life. I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us these wonderful ideas. I, first of all, would like for you to tell us how and where we can find out more. I mean, I can tell them, but I'd like to hear. I have to say that in this entire interview, I have loved listening to you. I don't care what you're talking about. Okay. You have the clarity of speech, the dexterity, if you will, the articulation, maybe that's a better word, that I have strived to sort of facilitate in others in terms of their ability to speak, not only speak clearly and to be understood, but to give the kind of energy that what you're saying is what you're saying is important, and that comes across. You believe it's important. And so I just want to applaud you for that presentation. But folks can go to MalibuMastermind.com. Is that correct?
Close. MauiMastermind.com. That's okay. Or you said Malibu, which is nearby you. We're a little bit further across the pond there over the Pacific.
Maui.
Or they can... That's right, MauiMastermind.com. Or if they want to find out about the book, The Freedom Formula, two easy places. One is FreedomToolkit.com.
FreedomToolkit.com.
Or just go to your local bookseller, whether you like to buy at Barnes & Noble's or local independent stores or on the big behemoths like Amazon online.
Yeah.
I think you'll really enjoy the book. I think it's a worthwhile read.
I would agree with you. Also, too, to the end of the big behemoth Amazon, you know, I don't have a problem with Amazon. And if it undermines other smaller businesses, you know, in our evolutionary process as human beings over the last hundreds of thousands of years, we've seen change. I don't think that the horse and buggy people cared too much when the automobile came on the scene. I don't think that the trains and stagecoaches cared a whole lot when airplanes began to take people from one place to another. The telegraph industry probably didn't like it too much when telephones, and now we got these smartphones. You don't need wires anymore. Well, at least not initially. And so, I mean, this is just, it's part of the process. And Amazon won't be here forever, and something will come along to replace it. It's just the evolutionary process. So we need to kind of calm down. Calm down and it'll be okay. I have three final questions I'd love to ask you. And by the way, should you ever find yourself here on the mainland and here in Santa Barbara, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. And my three final questions for you, David, are number one, who is David Finkel?
I'm going to say I'm a dad, I'm a husband, I'm a business person, and I'm just a person trying to figure out his own life.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to help thousands and thousands and thousands of business owners fall in love with their business again so that they can create value in the lives of customers. They can create a workplace that really serves and they can have a sense of doing something important that they love, that that's well paid and creates a sense of freedom for them too.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To help be a light in the world. I look at it that way. How can I be a source of inspiration, empowerment, warmth, direction, education, illumination?
Well, I thank you once again, and I'll answer that aspect by just saying keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Richard.
I really appreciate it. Stay on the line. We're going to let our listeners know that if you'd like to hear the entire interview, please go to the podcast. You're listening to the radio broadcast right now, and we encourage you to go to the podcast on SoundCloud and all the other outlets we've mentioned. And until next time, this has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Love, Talal.